or whatever the subject was. I was not put in a segregated room, but I attended the regular classes with my sighted peers. It's too dumb to know that if you read Braille, you're supposed to read slower. So I didn't read slower. Anyway, Braille was my first language. I have to tell you, this is a rambling speech. Maybe you already guessed it. When I was born, at the age of 2 weeks, I went into a coma. And I was in a coma for 6 weeks. And I was diagnosed with encephalitis. And nobody thought that I would live. And as you can tell now, it has affected my mind. But anyway, that is not the cause of my blindness. I had a full-blown case of macular degeneration and a full-blown case of retinitis pigmentosa at birth. And so I was born totally blind. And I guess I still have those conditions. Anyway, I will go back to my loving family. My father, I guess, he never took a formal course in orientation and mobility, but he made it his business to take me where we were going, each time via a different route, so that I would develop a sense of direction. And he would walk me along the street, and he'd say, "We are now walking west. When we come to the corner, we're going to make a left turn. And then we will be walking south." And he made me pay attention to the direction in which the traffic was moving. He said, "On this street, the traffic is moving from behind you and passing you, and it will leave you from in front of you. But when we get to the next street, the traffic will be coming toward you from in front of you, and it will leave you moving behind you." And that's how the streets are. For one-way streets, the traffic on one street goes in one direction, and the traffic on the next street goes in the opposite direction. And my father made sure that I understood the letters of the alphabet. He let me touch the raised lettering on U.S. mailboxes, and the raised lettering on fire call boxes and police call boxes. He even let me trace the lettering on neon tubing on the outside of store windows so I would learn the shape of script letters. Sometimes when I touched those neon tubings, they would begin to buzz. Anyway, they just buzzed. They didn't do any damage. And he let me touch the raised letters on license plates of automobiles. And he bought me large blocks with raised printed letters. And he bought me large rubber stamps with raised printed letters. And so I was knowledgeable about the shapes of letters. It is my view that it is important for blind children today to know what printed letters look like. Our whole vocabulary is replete with references to printed letters. And if a child does not know what the shape of those letters are, he is at a loss to understand the reference. There are C-clamps, and I-beams, and O-rings, and S-hooks, and T-squares, and U-turns, and V-neck sweaters, and dotting L's, and all of these expressions which are common in our language are references to letters of the alphabet, which if you don't know what their shape is, you're at a loss of understanding what stage is. And he told me, "We are not required to complete the work, but neither are we free to desist from engaging in it." And I always lived by that whatever needed to be done, I did it. I didn't necessarily complete it, but I did it as good as I could. And it is better to light a candle than to curse the dark. And whenever I encountered an obstacle that I, as a blind person, found at first difficult or impossible to do, he encouraged me to devise a way. And he helped me sometimes to find a way. I'll give you an example. When I was a freshman or a sophomore in college, all of my buddies who were also freshmen and sophomores, they were building amateur radios. Now, in those days, you didn't buy an amateur radio. You went out, you bought chassis, you bought vacuum tubes, and you bought resistors and condensers and induction coils, and you had a set of them together. Now, I had no problem making the connections. I just bent the wires in nice loops and put them through the eyelets. I had a set of them. How in the world am I going to solder them? But I figured out a way. I put the solder with the cold solder with the solder belongs, and all the other connections. And I took a sharp pencil, and I put the point of the pencil at the point where the solder joint should be. And holding that pencil firmly in my left hand, I picked up the hot soldering iron, which was laying on enamel cover table, and with that hot soldering iron, I flailed around here and there until I could engage the pencil with the tip of the soldering iron. And then little by little, I let the pencil guide the tip of the soldering iron to the joint where it belonged. And when the solder iron touched the solder and melted it, and the odor was just right, I knew that I had succeeded in performing. Another way of lighting a candle instead of cursing the dark. My uncle was a handyman. He did plumbing jobs and carpentry jobs and electrical jobs, and he used to like to take me along with him. And he was very patient, and he showed me how to do these various things. Today, I can easily fish an electric wire through a wall and make an outlet if I have to. When I had my own home with my wife, she bought all the chandeliers, and I hung and wired every single one of them. You got a full ladder? Yeah. Anyway, he taught me all those things. My mother trained my memory. She would give me a list of 6 or 7 grocery items. Not only the items, but the quantities. I had to bring them back in the correct quantities and not bring anything extra or leave out anything. And I had to bring back the correct change. But she was not nervous about having me go to the grocery store because I didn't have to cross any streets. I just walked at the corner, made a left turn, and walked past 2 entrances, and the 3rd entrance was the grocery store. And furthermore, the grocer was my grandfather. So anyway, I went and I brought back all those things. Now, in those days, you didn't buy a carton of sour cream in a nice plastic bag, you know, sealed tightly. You would bring a glass, a drinking glass. And my grandfather would ladle out a glass full of sour cream, put a piece of paper on the top of a rubber band to hold it in place, and that's what I had to carry home. And the same thing with butter. He would have a scale. He would cut pats of butter or a piece of butter, put it on the scale, and charge you by the weight. He didn't buy a pound of butter in 4 sticks of a quarter each. My grandfather had an icebox. It wasn't in the refrigerator. It was an icebox, a rubber tube. And the purpose of the rubber tube was, as the ice melted, the tube would drain into the sink, and it would be gently kept. carried away by the drain hole in the sink. Well, my uncle had trained me well. I saw a loose tool laying in the sink. And I touched it this way and that way. I said, that doesn't make any mechanical sense, a loose tool laying in the sink. It belongs connected somewhere. And so I looked around. Where could it be connected? The drain hole was much too big. That obviously not right. Then I saw the faucet. And I gingerly put the tool to the end of the faucet. And I saw it was a nice snug fit. So I said, aha, that's where it belongs. Well, little by little, of course, as the water drained, it backed up and up and up until it finally wet the stuff in the icebox above.
Oh my.
2.5 hours later, my grandfather came looking for me. Anyway, that was the result of my uncle's good training. Because I knew that those rubber tubes didn't make any mechanical sense. Anyway, I had good training. You know, any time I wanted to do something, I was encouraged to figure out a way to do it myself. Nobody came running to my assistance. My grandmother had a wonderful saying. She said, with somebody else's hands, it's good to shovel coal. Anyway, I learned to do things myself. When I grew up at the New York Jewish Guild of Blind, my mother had a hard time coping with the fact that she had a blind child. And she had a nervous breakdown, and she had to be institutionalized for a year and a half. She came home completely rehabilitated. But meanwhile, my father by himself was not able to cope with a job and a child and so on. So he sent me to live at the New York Jewish Guild for the Blind and Yonkers. And he came to visit me. Then when my mother recovered, she would come also. And she would bring me wonderful things. In season, she would bring me a nice, soft persimmon. You ever eat a persimmon? They're delicious. You mustn't eat them when they're hard. You'll get a mouthful of chalk. But anyway, she would bring all those from home. Weekends I traveled home. I spent weekends at home, and my grandfather would take me to the synagogue. He would take me to the synagogue early on a Saturday afternoon. And for 2 or 3 hours before other people began arriving, he and I were the only ones there. And he would choose a tractate of the Talmud off the shelf at random and open it at random. And he would begin to read it and explain to me what was in there. He didn't make any effort to teach me in a systematic way. But he taught me well those sections that he chose, but he did it over such a long period of time that finally, in my mind, the passages became connected, and I could see the overall picture. Now, even the encyclopedia is pretty good, which has what 15 or 18 volumes in print. The Talmud has, I think, 47 volumes. And that's very elaborate. And believe me, if you study Talmud and if you study mathematics for a long time, it exhilarates the mind. And I'm very fortunate, and thank the Lord, that whatever He has tampered with me, He has not tampered my memory or my mind. And I'm able to do everything that I used to do. I try to keep current with developments in computer science. As a matter of fact, I wrote a program to give blind people a scientific calculator which after I wrote the program, I gave away to the National Federation of the Blind, and they have it on sale today. They sell it for, I think, $45 or something like that. Calculator of comparable capability that you would buy from Radio Shack or from Texas Instruments or something would cost $350 or $400. It has 15 digits of precision. And, you know, you can get as much precision as you want with a calculator, and you can divide, you know, two numbers, but who knows how many of them are correct. On the Freedom Scientific Calculator, I try to enter the sine of 30 degrees, and I get an answer of 0 point, followed by 7 or 8 zeros, and then some straight digits. I know the answer should be all zero point, it's a half. 0.5 followed by as many zeros as you would like. But the calculator gives me a couple of stray digits at the end, which I know are not correct. And that makes me wonder how many of the final digits in an answer are other sines and cosines that are not so easily amenable are correct. But in my calculator, all of the significant digits are correct the last 15 places. I was persuading Microsoft to give me the source code for the mathematical functions in the calculator. And I have that source program now. And of course, that is proprietary information, but it is extremely accurate. I once tried to explain to Mark Maurer how big a range that calculator has. I said that calculator runs from 10 to the minus 208 power to 10 to the plus 208 power. Now I said, that is several thousand magnitudes bigger than the mass of the entire universe compared to the mass of one electron. He said, that boggles the mind. Anyway, NFB has that calculator, and it talks very nicely to you, and it works very well. It's a scientific it does more than add and subtract and multiply and divide. It does logarithms and cosines and tangents and factorials and all those fancy words. When I was going to Brooklyn College, I was always interested in mathematics. And my counselors, I was fortunate not to have a student disability office to contend with. But when I went to Brooklyn College, I had a counselor who told me that mathematics is not a suitable goal for a blind person. And so, reluctantly, I majored in psychology. Now, those of you who have majored in psychology have probably heard of Dr. Abraham Maslow.
Yes.
Abraham Maslow was my professor, my mentor, and my friend. And he ran seminars at his home, 1232 Ocean Avenue, right behind Brooklyn College. And he ran seminars at his home. And when his wife gave birth to their second daughter, as an act of courtesy, all us participants in the seminar chipped in, and we bought him a 6-month subscription to diaper service. And anyway, even after I was a married man, you know, I had this major in psychology. I finished my master's degree at prestigious Columbia University, but I could not get a job as a blind person. So one day, my wife said to me, "Tell me the truth. Wouldn't you rather be an unemployed mathematician than an unemployed psychologist?" And so, you know, that changed my life. I began, from that point on, I thought of myself as a mathematician and not as a psychologist. And as some guys go to Brooklyn College, some guys go to play poker or bowling or whatever they do one night a week, it was my pleasure to go to Brooklyn College and take a math course. Now, I didn't care if people thought I was a geek or not. I went to Brooklyn College and took a math course. And in 1936, men were coming home after the war. And they had taken Calculus 1, and they had passed it, and they were eligible to take Calculus 2. And I leave it to you to imagine how much Calculus 1 they remembered after the war. Anyway, we set up a help session for them, a large room, and the room was all around, it wasn't walls, it was blackboards. Three sides of the room were blackboard, only the door was not a blackboard. And I was a volunteer there. And those volunteers would go around and ask the students to read, you know, to put as much on the blackboard of a problem as they could. And I would go around as a volunteer and tap a guy on the shoulder and ask him to read me the problem in the textbook. I said, okay, what did you put on the board? He said, nothing. So I began patiently explaining the rationale of the problem, and after I did the proper amount of talking, I picked up a piece of chalk and I wrote the first formula on the blackboard. And then I did a little more talking and wrote the second formula and so on until I showed them how to think through the solution of that problem. What I didn't know was that I was being observed by the chairman of the mathematics department. And I kept doing this volunteer work all semester long. And one Friday night, I got a telegram from the chairman of the math department. And my brother opened the telegram. He said, it's from the math department, chairman. I said, good Lord, what did I do? But he read the telegram to me, and he told me that the telegram said that one of the staffers in the department had taken ill, would be gone for the semester, and would I take his classes. And that's how I got my first teaching job. And learned just enough to know what to teach the following Monday night. Anyway, my first assignment was to teach a required math course to a bunch of social science majors. They did not particularly enjoy taking a math course, but it was required. And furthermore, I was not at liberty to choose the topics to teach. I was given a syllabus, and I was supposed to teach each topic within a certain period of time. And one of the topics was conversion series. Now, everybody plays around with a conversion series like this. 1 + 1/2 plus a quarter plus an eighth plus a sixteenth and so on. Each new term is 1/2 the size of the previous term. And you keep adding these together and you get closer and closer to 2. And I taught my students the proper vocabulary, the limits 2, the series converges to 2, and if you go home and use that language for your father, he will know that his money for tuition is being well spent. Anyway, after I got them to understand about this conversion series, I proposed another series. 1 + 1/2 plus a third plus a quarter plus a fifth and so on. Now, I said, does that converge? You know, does that get closer and closer to some number? Well, I got a lively discussion going, and there were 13 students in the class. And some thought it converged, and some thought it didn't. I said, okay, this is a social science class. Let's put it to a vote. So, I put it to a vote, and after the poll was taken, 8-5, it converged. So then I went to the blackboard and I put a proof on the blackboard that this series diverges. And if you take enough terms, it'll get bigger than 10. If you take enough more terms, it'll get bigger than 100. And if you take enough terms, it'll get bigger than 1,000,000. It diverges. And I said to them, the lesson that I want to teach you is this. 3 years from now, as social scientists, you will hardly remember what a series is, and much less you will remember anything about convergence or divergence. The lesson that I want to teach you is this. You only put things to a vote when nobody knows the answer. When somebody knows the answer, you don't put things to a vote. And that was a lesson that I wanted to teach you. So, anyway, how much more time do I have, Carl?
5 minutes.
Five more minutes. Yeah. Okay, very good. Anyway.
5 o'clock.
I really hated to say that.
Anyway, I was married in 1944. My wife's name was Florence. She was diabetic and she had lost most of her eyesight through diabetes, retinopathy of diabetes. And she was undertaking some experimental therapy. And believe it or not, she regained her full eyesight in one eye with this therapy. And so, so much so that she threatened to go and take a drive. I said, okay, you drive, I'll walk. Anyway, she did not get her driver's license, but she was a great help to me. And we were married 26 years. We were married on September the 10th, 1944. And she died on September the 10th, 1970. Oh. And not long afterwards, I met another young lady. Well, she was 8 years my senior, so... and she already had 3 grown children from a husband who she had recently lost. And interesting story. There was a Detroit shopping news. It was full of grocery ads, you know, all the sports advertising. But it accepted personal ads without cost. And I needed some reading assistance at that time because my wife was no longer here. And the lady in the synagogue got a hold of this other lady. I just lost her husband. And said, you have nothing to do. This is a nice guy. He's intelligent. He's this and he's that. And we'll meet him. So she came to read to me. And two or 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, she read to me. 1 week, she read to me the Riot Act. And so we were married. I inherited 3 grown children, 2 infant grandchildren. One of them was maybe 11 months old or 10 months old, and I used to entertain her by making animal noises. Anyway, when she got to be a teenager, her mother and father sent her to Israel to study at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And as part of her arrangement for paying back some of her tuition, she stayed up and volunteered to work on a kibbutz. And they gave her the outdoor animals to take care of. And one day, I got a letter from her. Dear Grandpa A, the cows here sound just like you. Now, that girl now is married, has 3 children of her own, and I'm in frequent touch with her. She's the only grandfather she ever knew. And I'm in touch with all of the stepchildren. I have a son, a stepson, who lives in Toledo, Ohio, which is about 65 miles from Detroit. And he comes every 2 or 3 weeks, and he takes me on expeditions, a bar or a bank or whatever I need. And I enjoy him, and I have 2 stepdaughters, all they're all married, they all have kids, and one of them has three boys. The older boy is a professor at Georgia Tech, senior professor at Georgia, and his specialty is metallurgy, a special kind, the kind of metal composite material used for space construction, space travel. And but he likes to send me jokes on the internet. One time he sent me a joke, and this was a letter written by a girl to Dear Abby. Dear Abby, my boyfriend and I have been living together now 2.5 years. And you know those pills that I take are getting to be expensive. And I think that he should share in the cost of those pills. But my problem is that I don't know well enough to talk about money. So, anyway, he keeps sending me these stories all the time. The latest story he sent me was about a gentleman who was driving 20 miles an hour above the speed limit at 1 o'clock in the morning. And of course, he was stopped by a police officer. Police officer, then where do you think you're going at 1 o'clock in the morning so fast? He said, officer, I'm going to a lecture. He says, a lecture? Who gives lectures at 1 o'clock in the morning? He said, my wife. Anyway, I've lived a very happy, full life. And I have to tell you that my invention of the Net of Code, which I didn't even talk about during this long harangue, was just another manifestation of lighting a candle instead of cursing the dog. When there was no way in Braille to do the mathematics that I needed to do, I devised a way of doing it. I didn't depend on somebody else to do it, because that's like shoveling coal. And I did it myself in order to help myself. Now, for some time I worked at the American Foundation for the Blind. And during that time, I put all the material that Helen Keller needed into Braille, her itineraries, her dining car menus and everything, so I knew the lady because I wrote everything for her in Braille. And there was a gentleman there, his name was Clifford Witcher. And Clifford Witcher worked in the research department. He was a PhD, having studied physics at Columbia University, and he was 9. And one day he asked me if I had a table of integrals. I said, yes, I have a table of integrals, but you won't be able to read it because it's written in a private code that only I developed and know. He said, I'm desperate, teach me your code. So I did that. And he was on a mathematics subcommittee. In those days, it was called the Joint Uniform Braille Committee. The word joint was intended to reflect that its members were jointly from the United States and from Great Britain. And he suggested that they look into this code because he found it very useful. And so they contacted me and asked me to write a short report. I wrote a report. It wasn't quite as short as they expected. Anyway, I submitted the report. One Friday afternoon, they asked me to appear before this august committee to present the rationale of my code, which I did. And Friday afternoon, it was adopted and became the 1952 edition of the Net of Code, and it has been used ever since. It has been used in the United States and in Great Britain, not in Great Britain, but in Canada and in New Zealand. And I understand that it is used in India, and it is used for advanced mathematics students in Japan, and I don't know where else. One day I got a call from the State Department in 1972. They went over to the Soviet Union. I said, the Soviet Union? What's the Soviet Union for me? Well, they said they heard that you devised this code, and that it's being used in various countries around the world, and they would like to know about it. So I said, okay, I'm willing to go and tell them, but who's going to take this here junket? So I said, well, the Soviet Union has agreed to pay all the expenses for you and your wife. So my wife and I were there in 1972, and there was a conference, and I told them all about the Nenna Code, which they did not adopt. And 4 years later, in 1976, I get another call. Do you want to go back to the Soviet Union? I said, well, what now? I said, I told them all about the Nenna Code. There's nothing more I can tell them. No, no, they don't want to know about the Nenna Code anymore. I will try to convince you of the language that they use. They want to know how the hell a blind person can access the screen of a computer. So I went and I told them how the hell a blind person can access the computer. Anyway, when I was there, we were given very VIP treatment. They assigned to us a chauffeur and a guide. And they told us that just give us a half hour's notice and they will take you wherever you want to go. And that chauffeur guy had no other assignment except to take care of me and my wife during the duration of the time that we were there. So anyway, of course, since we were in such close contact with the guy and the chauffeur, she shared with me some of the jokes that were currently going on in the Soviet Union. At that time, the chairman of the Soviet Union was Leonid Brezhnev. You may remember Leonid Brezhnev. The joke was going around, some guy somehow got into the Kremlin, and he was running up and down the halls yelling, Brezhnev is a fool, Brezhnev is a fool. He said it didn't take long, the KGB arrested him, and they gave him a very quick trial, quicker than you get in the U.S. And the judge sentenced him to 13 years, 3 years for creating a disturbance in a public building, and 10 years for revealing a state secret. Those were my experiences in the Soviet Union. You know, I'm quite well connected to the blindness community, and one day I get a call. And to my surprise, the caller at the other end of the phone was Governor Engler of Michigan, our previous Republican governor. And he said, I'm calling you because I would like to appoint you to the Michigan Commission for the Blind. So I made the proper noises. I said, I'm pleased and I'm privileged and so on and so on. He said, you know, I'm not supposed to ask you, but I'm curious to know what your political party affiliation is. So I said, well, I'm a Democrat. Oh, he said, in that case, I'm going to make you the chairman. So I served as chairman of the Michigan Commission for the Blind for 2 years, from 1991 till 1993. Politics, however, was not my cup of tea, but I think I laid a pretty good groundwork to get a literacy bill passed in the state of Michigan. And though it was not passed in the time of my tenure of the commission, it was passed shortly thereafter, and I take partial credit for the successful passage of the literacy bill. Well, now if anybody cares to write my biography as a result of this lecture, well, but I think I'm through right now. When I grew up on the Lower East Side, my playmate, this is an encore, my playmate was Zero Mostel, and he was my playmate, and we used to go around and we used to filch empty orange crates from grocery stores, discarded baby buggies, and we got some extra pieces of lumber and we built a wagon, and of course the wagon didn't have a steering wheel, but a loop of rope attached to each wheel. So if you pull with your left hand, it turns left. And if you pull with your right hand, it turns right. So we'd run that away through the gentle slopes of the Lower East Side, and we'd have a great time together. And every Saturday night, my father would take me to the Mostel household. And while we kids played around in another room, the adult men, and Zero had several brothers, and there were other people there, and they had big bookkeeping ledgers with posts that were 10 inches high. And what were they doing? They were keeping records. And what kind of records? They were lending money, interest-free. And those immigrants would take this money, and they would first establish a home, and then they would establish a business. And after a year, the business was successful, and they would repay the loan, interest-free. But they were always added gratuity, and they had more money to lend to to take care of the needs of their people without going outside of the community, but they took care of it all by themselves, and it worked perfectly well. And so I knew all Zero's brothers and sisters. Zero's brother Morris was my father's accountant for 23 years. And so that is my story about Zero myself.